Hey everyone, this is Space Cafe Podcast, and I am Marcus. Hey, this one's for all you private space detectives, or whatever you call yourself these days. The times are ideal for new terminologies, right? We've already had space archaeologists on the show and a space lawyer just recently. What else is in store for us? A job posting for space tourism manager and space transportation manager I just spotted recently. It sounds like a fun game if it weren't real. And that's what's so great about it, right? Back to the space detectives. In today's episode, we're facing a strange object hovering in low Earth orbit, and no one seems to be raising a hand to its origin. Any clues, and I'm being serious here, any clues are greatly appreciated. Our guest today is no one other than Annie Handmer, host and author of the Space Junk podcast, and most importantly, senior manager of innovation and policy at HEO Robotics, an Australian space startup that performs space-based imaging and in-orbit inspections. And Annie acquainted me with that strange object.
How are you, Marcus?
That no one knows where it comes from or what it is or what it looks like. It's just out there. Let's find out more, okay? Annie, the microphone is yours. Welcome to the studio.
Okay, sounds good. How long do you want to record for?
I don't know. It's my secret.
My name is Dr. Annie Handmer, and I am from Sydney in Australia. I work at a company called HEO Robotics, where I do their product management, and I also do some of the innovation work at the company. And in terms of likes, dislikes, I like stars, and I dislike the thought of a piece of space debris landing on my head, but I think it's pretty unlikely.
But there's a likelihood. So what are the odds that something falls on your head?
Incalculably small. In fact, there's a company in Australia, an insurance company, that ran an advertisement for home and contents insurance a few years ago, and they said that they'd insure you for all sorts of things, including space junk falling on your roof. So I contacted them because I was like, how do you calculate that risk? And they were like, we don't. That's just marketing. So, but they do cover it, which is quite fascinating.
Isn't that great? Now we're talking about it. So that's a successful strategy already.
I suppose so, yeah.
Very Absolutely. Nice. So if nothing falls on our heads or barns or houses, why do we care about space debris in the first place? So why is that a thing if it's not an issue?
Well, it's a very interesting question. For many years, I've been very interested in space debris myself, and I ran a podcast for a number of years, still sort of run it, called Space Junk, which wasn't really about space debris, but touched on it. And I think there's a few things going on with space debris. I think part of it is obviously that there is a risk posed by objects, but, you know, space is kind of a paradox because it's enormously large. But also the risk if something does run into something else is just catastrophic. So the chances of a collision occurring are really low, but the consequences are really high. And I think there's something about the way that we like to think about things as humans where we really find these events fascinating, these things that are really catastrophic but really unlikely, kind of take up more space in our minds as well. So that's
because it's looming over our heads.
Yeah, it's like kind of like, you know, is there a monster in the cupboard? It's that kind of thing. Then the other side of it, though, is that when we think about space debris, I think there's something there around the consciousness of the human impact on the environment that that speaks to us. And as we look at our environment, you know, in front of us on the street or our harbors, our oceans, and we see the effects of pollution and human interference, we like to imagine space as being a clean place. So there's something kind of horrifying about imagining junk flying around. And I think that is something that does capture the imagination of a lot of people and in kind of a different way to the way that you your imagination is captured by just planets and stars and satellites and so on. So it's also a kind of opportunity that we look out at space and what we see there, we reflect back to what we're doing on Earth. And when we look up and we think about debris, that makes us feel more aware of our impact on the environment generally. Whereas if we look up and we just see stars or we just think about stars, we might think differently. But Marcus, you've interviewed a lot of people, so I'm sure you could tell me what's interesting about debris as well.
Good question. Thanks for bouncing this back to me. So I feel like this is a very strange situation we're in because there is this danger looming above our heads, and at the same time, we don't see it like the average person from down below. I just came back from a holiday with my family, so we spent a little time at the beach. And so during nightfall, I love spending time at the beach just looking up on the sky. I love playing with my GoPro and doing like long time exposures and watching the Milky Way and perhaps a little bit of Perseid showers. And so you feel like that this place up there is clean and pristine, but it's not. And that's the interesting thing. So it's pretty much the same with our oceans. We feel like they're pristine and they're clean, but they're not. And so the appearance is the issue, because if we don't see the problem, there is no problem. And so we don't care about the problem. So is this something also that you're experiencing in your daily work?
Yeah, totally. So I should probably give a bit of an introduction to what we do at HERE Robotics. So HERE Robotics is an Australian company, and we've got offices in the UK and also an employee in the US now. And we take pictures of objects in orbit from satellites in orbit. So imagine that you've got a Formula One racing car and it's going super, super fast down a track. You've got another Formula One racing car going the opposite direction. And you've got, let's say they're 100 kilometers apart. And you've got a camera like your iPhone up against the window and you're in one of the cars. And you get a photo as the car goes past. And you're trying to basically get a photo that's good enough that you can read the license plate on the car that went past. So that's what we're doing, but in space, which makes it really difficult. But we use software to help us do that. And the idea is kind of what you say, Marcus, which is if we can't see the problem or we can't see really anything like that's happening in space, we can't solve it. We can't do anything about it. It becomes so much harder to understand what we're dealing with. Whereas if you can, and you can now with software, take these amazing pictures of objects in orbit, suddenly you have a completely different relationship to that object. And to speak personally, I thought, I don't know, my perception of space has changed since doing this and since having the opportunity to look at these pictures. So I always thought of space as like so far away, like just incredibly far away. And then when I started to look at the actual maps of it, I realized the ISS orbits at around 400, 420 kilometers. That's really only the distance from, say, Canberra to maybe Newcastle, a bit less. I'm using Australian East Coast measurements, so go look it up.
I could say Vienna, Munich, for example.
Vienna,
so
Munich?
People can really,
Perfect. Perfect.
Yeah.
And see, that's not very far. So if I'm in Canberra and I've got family in Newcastle, I can get in the car and drive there in a few hours, or I can, like, get a photograph sent to me in an instant. But I think of space and I think it's so far away until I start to think of it as it's not that far. And what's weird to me is we launch things on a rocket. So you spend all this time building a satellite, you know, getting to know it, putting it together, doing all of your testing and so on. You load it onto your rocket. It launches into space and you never see it again. Like you can track it as a point of light. You can look at simulations of where it is. You can look at models of what you think it looks like, but you never really get to look at it again. And so the opportunity to look at these objects using cameras that are in space is just amazing because instantly it's a mindset shift of this object is really close. This object is real. And there's something maybe we can do. We can start to do things once we have features. But yeah, we can talk more about that.
So Annie, tell me what happens to the objects we bring into space, the LEO objects. Do they all over time tend towards falling back on Earth and burn up in the atmosphere? Or what happens to those objects?
Well, some of them, I mean, over time, yes, they'll come back in and burn up in the atmosphere, as people say. But if the object's big enough, then it won't entirely burn up. So that's where we see objects falling back to Earth, or depending on what it's made of. And also it takes a long time for that to happen. So it's kind of like any natural cycle, I guess. All of these things take a long time. And we're putting so many objects into space that, you know, that the mass doesn't quite line up, right?
Yeah.
So that is a factor. But that said, I mean, debris is one problem. And people have heard a lot about debris. What I find really interesting is the unidentified objects in space.
So you wouldn't call that debris?
Well, it's not always debris. So I'm going to give you numbers because I just pulled this off this morning from our platform. Mm-hmm. So there are 26,016 tracked objects in space that are tracked by a U.S. service called SpaceTrack, which...
Like rocket bodies, like larger satellites, outdated satellites.
And functioning satellites too.
Okay.
So 26,016 objects. Now, of those, 13,981, so almost 14,000, are considered to be debris. So they're tagged as debris. But there are 323 objects as of this morning that are called unknown. So they're objects that have been launched into space and we don't know what they are. So they could be debris or they could be functioning satellites. So we started using our cameras and the sensors we have access to at HERA Robotics to take pictures of some of these unknown objects and start, try and figure out, like, what are they? Why are they unknown? And some of them are debris. So we recently released a white paper identifying one piece of debris, one unknown object, sorry, called Object K, to be precise, Object 2021-033K, but we know it as Object K, as a piece of debris. But there are other objects that we've imaged that are unknown objects that turn out to be functioning satellites. And they've just been launched and they haven't been registered as being functioning. And that is something that I think we can definitely change and would make space a lot more, I guess, safe when you know what things are. Now, that's just unknown objects.
Are we talking, because you're saying we do not know what those objects are, but someone does know, right? So is that mostly secret stuff, like government stuff?
Not necessarily. So there are a range of tracking services. Some of those objects will be pieces of debris that have occurred as part of, say, a breakup, that, like, they might be part of a rocket body or something. Mm-hmm. And just it's happened and no one really knows where it came from. They think it, you know, no one's quite sure. They call it unknown. Some of them will be things that have been launched by non-Western countries. So no doubt somewhere on someone's register, they know what these things are.
Okay.
But then there are some objects that are unexpected bits of debris, like Object K that we released a report about, where we just don't know whether anyone really does know what that is, because it wasn't a planned object to be in orbit. Does that make sense?
Yes, totally. So, so would you like then send out a mass snap to the world and go like, so what is that piece? So for any kind of information, please do send it to mailbox Annie Hadmer.
Oh, absolutely. We're super interested. So we put out our white paper on Object K. We put out our hypothesis based on our research, and we did some 3D modeling where we say we think that it's half of a payload fairing from a Long March 6 rocket from 2021. But we don't know, and if you read the report, you'll see that it's kind of unusual that you'd find it where it is. So we're very interested in why and how it got there. And the reason I'm interested in that is the more you know about how debris is created, the better you can get at mitigating the risk of creating more debris. So by all means, if anybody out there has information, please send it to us. We'd really love to hear it. And we're going to keep imaging these unknown objects and releasing our reports on them as we go as well.
Great. How do you go about imaging? How does that work? Do you do it from Earth, or do you do it from orbit?
Yeah. So we do it from orbit. We don't launch our own satellites. So instead, we use time on existing satellites through our suppliers. So there are a lot of Earth observation satellites whizzing around in orbit. Most of the time, they're not doing anything. So most of the time, they're not imaging because they're over
oceans. Most of the time, seriously?
Most of the time, yeah. Wow. Somewhere above 90% of the time, they're not taking pictures.
Interesting. So, but that's not a business model, I guess, for those who are responsible for it.
Well, I guess they make enough money from that 10% or less than that it makes it worth it. But when we come along and we say, hey, work with us, we'll buy some time during the time that you're over clouds or over oceans, that works really well. So if you are a supplier and you're listening to this, if you're someone who's got a satellite in orbit with a camera on it, please do get in contact. Wow. So you get
for that time you buy on that satellite, you get then for that time being the controls of the camera, and you can like turn around the camera and focus them on whatever you want to focus them on.
Yeah, so we use our software to tell the camera basically where to point and when to click, and that's why we know. We get the best images because we've done a lot of work on kind of when is the lighting at its best and so on. So we use these cameras that wouldn't otherwise be used. And we think that's important because otherwise you're just launching more pieces of stuff into space,
Super sustainable.
And then we get back the pictures from that. And we can do some processing and get a bunch of information about satellites. So it works very well from that perspective. And the other thing we're doing is we've started building our own cameras here in Australia that we are partnering with people who wouldn't ordinarily put a camera on their satellite to go into different orbits. So it's a great way of kind of getting more access and getting out there, taking pictures.
Nice. So just to wrap my head around that again. So there are satellites in orbit that observe stuff on Earth. And when they're idling, you take them over and you point their cameras on space debris or object Ks or whatever kind of object. Is that right?
Yeah, that's right.
Okay, good. Good, good. So any favorite object you have found so far? A personal favorite?
Oh, that's such a good question. Well, it's a little bit lame. But don't laugh at me, Marcus, but my favorite object to image is the ISS. And I know it's really late because you can see it from Earth, but that's why I love it. So I don't know if you did this, but when I was a kid, I was so excited when I was out at night and it was a clear night and you could see the ISS going over. And here in the Southern Hemisphere at the moment, it's a beautiful time to see the ISS. So you see it as this bright star, and it you just see it moving across the sky. Mm. And I always found looking at the stars that I loved seeing, like looking at the satellites, you know, because you look at them and just watch for a little while and see which ones are moving. The other day I saw some starlings, which was pretty exciting too. So you can see it going over. And then when we take pictures of it, there's something magical about seeing it up close and seeing the changes. You can see when the modules are there, when the crew are there, when they're not there. You can see things to do with like what's happening with the solar panels and all of those things. It's a really exciting thing. And I think the reason it's so exciting is not just that the ISS is kind of cool. It's also sort of coming to the end of an era, I guess, with the ISS. Yes.
Soon to be space debris.
Yeah, there's something kind of melancholic about looking at it. And I feel it's quite important in a way to document it for the future as well. This amazingly successful international collaborative project, which is just so unbelievably expansive in its goals and aims and achievements. It's remarkable that we've managed to have international scientific cooperation occurring off Earth for so many years. It's just mind-boggling. So I think that's why I really like that object.
Nice. Yeah, because it was the start of an era. Now it's the end of an era, but it's maybe also the beginning of something new. So Annie, who's your typical customer?
We have a range of customers. So as a startup, we're still finding, I guess, the right customers and finding what that interest is. At the moment, we obviously have, you know, interest from government and so on, who want to monitor their satellites and keep an eye on things, and various SSA providers. We also have commercial customers. So people who are, let's say you're launching a satellite, you want to take a picture of it once it gets to orbit to make sure that it is doing what it's meant to be doing, that there aren't any malfunctions, or maybe you've launched a satellite and there's something wrong with it. Like your comms are a bit off. You think there's something wrong with the electricity circuits and so on. We can go take a picture of it, tell you whether the solar panel has deployed, for example. So that's kind of one type of customer. We're also looking at trying to increase our uses for astronomy. So recently we started working on tilting satellites to look upwards instead of just down. And when you do that, you get this dark sky imagery, and we can start to get pictures that might be useful for astronomy and can supplement observing that's happening from other space telescopes or from the ground. Mm-hmm. I'm really excited by the astronomy applications personally. Mm-hmm. And then the other group that I think is a brilliant group is the active debris removal and space services market. So I don't know how much listeners will know about this, probably quite a lot. I think you've covered a fair bit of this content, but you know, let's assume that they haven't gone all the way back into everything.
Sure.
You've got your space services. So on Earth, when you've got a car, you take it to put petrol in it, you take it to get serviced. And when it breaks down at the end of its life, you go and you tow it somewhere and you recycle it. Or you at least get it off the freeway. But in space, we don't have that yet. We're working on it. So at the moment, we're kind of developing ways of refueling. We're developing ways of servicing. We're developing ways of removing objects, this active debris removal, either to deorbit or move them into graveyard orbit or whatever the case is. And that's very important for making sure that we can keep using space. But the challenge of all of these things is that they're what we often call dual use technologies. They're technologies where, you know, you can fly up to something and you can tinker around with it and fix it. That's fantastic. But what's stopping you from flying up to something and tinkering around and unfixing it? So what I'm really interested in is using our imaging to third party verify what's happening, to give confidence to people and reduce kind of that suspicion and that risk, so that everybody can kind of relax and be like, great, they are refueling. Great, I can see that object. that you know, that satellite with that grabby arm, grabbing that piece of debris that they said they were going to grab and deorbiting it. It's that kind of verification and the addition of credibility that I think could make it more possible to develop these sorts of space services without going down the route of causing more political unrest or,
absolutely,
I guess, suspicion, right? It's kind of like, yeah, it's like Pixar, it didn't happen kind of thing.
Totally, absolutely. I feel like, and thanks for talking about this, because this reminded me that the space industry in orbit is mostly a blind art. And that's fascinating, because everything that's going on up there is being controlled on monitors, but not with imagery from that place, but with spreadsheets and whatnot, and numbers going on. So if you take, so for example, James Webb, everything that happened on James Webb was not visual, because of course it's too far away and it wouldn't make any sense to have it in a, to have it present visually. So it's a blind art, and that's most fascinating. It's like as if we were walked blindfolded through our everyday procedures, whatever we're after, and that's really fascinating, because this requires additional skills and additional knowledge of everything. So bringing now vision into that world could open up a vast array of potential for everything. Not only a proof that this object is around that maybe I invested in, so for the investor, you can send him a nice high-resolution picture of their satellite. Mm-hmm. So it's there's a wide variety of potential in it. So how do you feel about the real unknown objects? So are you approached for UFO requests?
Well, there are two answers to that, Marcus, but if I told you, I'd have to kill you.
I'm only kidding.
UFOs. Well, okay, so the short answer is no. No one's ever come to me and said, there's a UFO. Can you tell me whether it's an alien?
But I need a high-res picture.
Yeah, so like, and I sort of live in hopes that we'll like spot something really alien out there. In fact, the co-founders of the company, Dr. William Crowe and Dr. Hiranya Jakhety, originally wanted to image asteroids, and they kind of ended up doing stuff closer to home. So, you know, there is that ambition with the company that eventually we'll be able to image anything in the solar system. So maybe there's an alien out there. We hope so. But on the UFO side of things, no, we haven't been asked to identify a UFO from that perspective. But yes, we are often asked to identify these unknown objects, which we would consider to be UFOs kind of in a less fun way. They're UFOs in the sense that they're unidentified flying objects, but they usually they're just a piece of a rocket or something.
Yeah.
But that is kind of important. As we said, there are all of these unknown objects, and maybe if we thought of them as UFOs, that would kind of give everyone much more impetus behind it. But we certainly think of them that way and feel very compelled to try and figure out what they are. The other problem is, of course, mistags. So you sometimes have objects that are tagged as debris but are actually functioning satellites. Or you have objects that are tagged as being satellites, but they're non-functioning and they should be classified as debris. So if you think about it, a database of any database of 26,000 things, you're going to have a few mistags in there.
Sure.
And issues. And that could cause problems. So, identifying those mistags is also part of it. So I guess what I mean is maybe not UFOs, but maybe, MFOs, misidentified flying objects.
Yes.
We're often looking at as well.
Yes.
But I want to go back, if I could, just to something you said before about ways of seeing and kind of what it means to add vision to or optical vision to the way that you see space. I think that's so fascinating. I'm so interested in what it means to see. And when we think about telescopes and optical sensors and radio sensors and so on, how it is that we sense. I think seeing is one word and works for optical, but the other one is sensing. So ways of sensing what's happening. Mm-hmm. When we see pictures that come from James Webb or any kind of cool telescope, we think that that picture is the picture, but these pictures are pieced together from information.
Exactly. And
I saw a very interesting article and I can't remember exactly the name, but I'm sure you can find it if you Google something like NASA Mars crayons. There was some images taken of Mars and the data took so long to crunch that instead they did like a paint by numbers on a wall, and the team at NASA had crayons and colored in based on the numbers that they'd gotten back from the data, what it looked like. And then that was kind of the image of Mars that we have. And they picked those reds and oranges and so on. And then that goes on to influence the way that we think about what Mars looks like. Even though that itself was kind of a visual representation of some data.
So maybe it's completely different.
What do you mean?
I mean, like, that Mars looks completely different because, I mean, like, we have all those layers of interpretation in between. So if we got to go there at some point and took a look for ourselves, maybe it's different.
Mm. Well, I'm sure it would feel different. When we look at Earth using Earth observation cameras and you see kind of the pale blue dot, or you see kind of the blues and the greens, when you're actually on Earth, it looks enormously different. So I'm sure we'll discover this and it'll change our perspectives again and again and again. And I think it's just a process of learning different ways of sensing and different ways of seeing and incorporating those into our understanding.
Fascinating. So what do you, speaking of space debris and in all its forms out there, what do you think about the next couple of years? Will we make it through the cloud of space debris, or will this now be the end of the space industry because we're congesting this place, making it unusable for good? Because we've been doing a great job with our oceans to like really pollute them, and now many places are already suffocating for lack of oxygen. So we're doing a good job in the oceans. So maybe we keep up the same work in space. It feels like the human condition is very strong still.
Yeah, I don't know whether it is the human condition. Is it the human condition, or is it just our economic kind of situation that leads us to run a kind of extractivist economy and pollute like this? Humans have been, you know, running around doing their thing for a very long time, and only some branches in the long, long history of our planet have decided to pollute to the extent that we do. So I don't know if I would, I've challenged that. I always challenge it when people say it's human nature, or it's just the way that humans are, because often that precedes something that really we should question. So, you know, is it human nature to have conflict all the time? Maybe not. When it comes to pollution, I guess the thing that's good about space is that, first of all, it's extremely big. And I know we said that about the oceans, and I know we said that about the land and so on. So I don't rely on that. But in the short term, it is extremely big. The main thing that means that I don't worry as much about this as maybe I could worry about it is that everybody is implicated in it in a very real way. So in a sense, when you pollute the oceans, there is an impact on everybody eventually. But in space, remember when I was talking at the beginning about how it's really big, but if one thing runs into another thing, it's catastrophic. everybody knows that. And that, I think, means that people are incentivized to try to make sure that what they're doing is better, better and better and better as we go. So that, you know, satellites are built with avoidance systems and with debris mitigation kind of principles embedded in them now. And we are moving towards being able to hopefully remove some key pieces of large debris, although it remains a massive challenge. So from that perspective, I think it's a question of timing. So how soon can we mitigate versus how soon are we adding lots of objects into space? And this is kind of why we choose to not launch our own satellites, because I think there's some irony in launching satellites to try to reduce the number of satellites or to try to, you know, it's like releasing a whole bunch of rubber ducks into the ocean to raise awareness about pollution. It's like, great that you created more pollution. So that's kind of, that's one way of looking at it. But that said, there are some amazing things happening. I think though, to be honest with you, Marcus, it's, important that everybody, and if we're listening and, you know, everybody on Earth thinks about this really carefully and, we don't fall into the trap of thinking that because we can't see it, because it's out of sight,
it's not there.
That it's not there. We really need to learn different ways of seeing, whether it's looking at a database of 26,000 objects and imagining 26,000 objects or, you know, visualizing it in our own way so that we can do something about it. That kind of process has to happen, I think. And I think it is happening. What do you think?
Well, you're very optimistic. And I think this is what we all should be at the moment, because we're being confronted with too much pessimism anyway these days. So I'm with you. I'm totally with you. At the same time, I think what we are lacking is communication about that topic. We need more and more efficient and more targeted space communication.
100%.
Because we know, of course, the bubble we are in, maybe, we know that we know some of the consequences of climate change. So we know that in a couple of decades, the southern parts of Europe, for example, as this podcast originates in Europe, won't be as inhabitable as they are today for lack of water. It's getting too hot and whatnot. So people will migrate to the north. I think what we should also take into account is that we're not only migrating on Earth to different places to seek shelter from our own doings. We also will be pressed to rethink the way of life and the quality of life we're leading in relation to the benefits of space technology. So if this space debris thing is not mitigated, there will be a massive change in the way we live. We may not have, or we will not have, that kind of podcast that we are having now. We will not have ATM machines. We will not have GPS and blah, blah, blah. People know about this. The bubble people know about
some
this.
Some people, yeah.
Some people know about this. So this is, I personally feel we are racing toward a filter that will filter out a culture that is not ready for a future. And I do not know, to be super honest, if we are ready to make it beyond that filter. We know what's at stake. We know what's coming, but I do not know if we are really ready to make it through. So what do you think? That's my positive rant.
Well, like all these things, there are so many ways of approaching it. I think deep down, Marcus, like I agree, and it terrifies me and deeply concerns me. At the same time, I don't like it when people say that it's something's inevitable or that we will do these things, because when you accept something as inevitable, you make it inevitable. Like it's a weird thing. And so it goes back to all of these things when people say, oh, well, conflict's inevitable, so therefore I'll look for a conflict. Well, if you don't start from the perspective that something is inevitable, but instead you start from the perspective that everything is avoidable, everything is changeable. From this moment forward, there are all sorts of things that can happen and all sorts of likelihoods. So you can say something is very likely, but inevitable, there's a finality to it that I find dangerous.
Yes.
And I know you weren't saying that it was inevitable, but in my own head, I have to stop myself all the time from thinking in that way. And I think that's why I try to think in more of an optimistic way, more of a positive way, because I think if I push myself to think in that way and other people also push themselves to think in that way, then we are more motivated and more capable of getting together and finding solutions.
Yes.
And we all have to agree that there's a challenge, but then we all have to agree that there must be a solution, or there must be many solutions. And together we'll work on many solutions. And that's kind of, I think, the most effective approach. But, you know, maybe I'll feel differently later. I'm not sure.
No.
I flip flop on it.
You're absolutely right. But, you know, I'd be interested to find out how you feel about my sentiment towards civil society missing in all this. So I feel like what we're missing is a major public voice. I mean, like, we have social media. We are voicing everything and anything these days. 2 billion people on Meta or whatnot, and 2 trillion on wherever. The question is, where is civil society in all this? Because I feel like that we are gravitating towards a post, a world where we may have the option and the opportunity to go beyond traditional political systems in whatever form that could evolve. I don't know. But the thing is, where is that voice? And this is what I'm missing, because the thing is, political leaders will always be affected by public voices. And it could be so easy, it feels, and at the same time it's so difficult.
I mean, it's not a you haven't given me an easy question, Marcus.
Yeah, I know.
Just solve the world. Let me think about it. Well,
maybe it's not a question. Maybe it's a statement you can just latch on to. And yeah,
I think it's an important statement, and it's definitely something that I think about frequently. I think we all have to think about this question. Part of the privilege of being alive and existing on this planet is, I think, comes, you know, there's a privilege, and then there's an obligation to think constructively about how to do better.
Yeah.
How to live better, how to be kinder, how to love more, you know, all of those things. And I personally, to go very personal for a minute, I've been thinking about this a lot recently, especially now that I've had time, like after finishing my PhD, to kind of sit back and think about, well, what am I doing and why? And you start to think about what's purpose, what's meaning, what brings your life meaning. And for me, and maybe for a lot of people, I think about my life and it's been very much defined by an awareness of the resources that I consume, the environmental destruction caused by the existence of humans. I am one of those humans and I cause disproportionate amounts of environmental destruction, no matter how much I recycle, because I exist and I exist in Sydney, Australia, and so on and so forth. So if I think about that, and then I think about what is the obligation, I think there is an obligation that comes with that privilege to try to improve the way that we do things as a society, to try to make things better, to try to make things safer, to try to ensure that we blow each other up less, to reduce suffering, whatever form that takes. And I mean, I think that that's on everyone. If you think about the challenge for civil society that you mentioned before, yeah, absolutely. I think this is something that everybody should and can think about and consider. Space is tricky because it exists invisibly often. When you don't see it, it's even harder to find the time to think about it. But that's also what's so brilliant about it. I mean, the Outer Space Treaty, the international processes, international cooperation, collaboration, the ISS, as we mentioned, all of these things are kind of magical because they bring together groups of people to work towards a common goal, which is doing something amazing off our planet that makes our lives better, that brings everyone up ideally. That's kind of got to be the goal, doesn't it? So I think that's why I'm optimistic, is that I have that privilege of being part of that world and knowing these people and being part of these conversations. And even when the problem seems totally intractable, the people around the problem who are thinking about it, who are trying to solve it, they give me a lot of hope that it can be solved and that we can do something. And I personally refuse to give up. I'm like, no matter how dire it looks, we just keep trying. We try different things. We do different things. We'll get there.
And we're all part of the solution. I think this is a very important piece of thought we need to consider. We should not expect someone to take care of the mess we're leaving behind. We are all part of that mess, and we are all part of that solution. That's just something to keep in the back of our heads.
Absolutely, because we're all kind of there's a great quote from Norbert Wiener, who's a guy who wrote about cybernetics, and I actually had this quote read at my wedding a few years ago, so I love it that much. And he says, "We're all shipwrecked passengers on a doomed planet." But he goes on to say that doesn't mean that, and I'm paraphrasing terribly. Yeah. He's like, but you know, my interpretation of his stance on this is like, we're shipwrecked passengers on a doomed planet. Thank you, Norbert Wiener. But doesn't mean we can't find time to have a cup of tea and a biggie and have a chat, which is what we've done today, which is so lovely.
I
think that's right. I think you kind of accept the first bit, and then it's up to everybody to decide what to do next about it.
Yeah. Annie, I love the spheres we're reaching with this in that podcast. So let me ask you this, for your upcoming journey into space, your personal one in the next spacecraft, what's the single most important tune you wouldn't want to miss on your iTunes playlist for that?
Oh, what music am I taking to space? Is this what you're asking me?
Yes. Just one tune. Because for real, we're building up a Space Cafe podcast playlist. So each guest contributes one one song.
Oh, that's brilliant. That's so brilliant. And I can't pick just one song because there are so many amazing songs out there. Just give me one
you
minute.
Payload. We have the payload problem, so we can't just pick one song.
Give me one second.
Sure. Sure.
So we have a little thing. You can cut this bit out while I mull.
No problem. No problem. It's all good.
So much good music. Oh, okay. Hang on. I know what I'm picking. All right.
And the playlist is live already, so you can check it out. So anyone who wants to check it out, it's on Spotify. It's called Space Cafe Podcast Guest Tunes.
That's awesome. Okay. The song I'm going to contribute is War Pigs by Black Sabbath.
Yes.
Such a song. And yeah. I think it's very important that metal gets representation
yes,
on this playlist totally. As a massive metalhead myself.
Yes. Oh my God. We could add a couple of hours now to that one. We should have started with that. Metal in space.
We should have. Metal in space. Well, is yeah. there, I mean, it just, it sums up the grandeur and
yes.
the kind of, the overwhelming nature of it
yes.
all. Yeah, I love it so much.
Awesome. Annie, last question in our podcast is a question every guest gets asked, and that is, this is a Space Cafe podcast. It's a coffee place. In coffee places, you sometimes get to have an espresso to energize yourself. So what's the espresso for the mind you would like to share with our audience? To energize and inspire our audience.
An espresso for the mind. What have other people chosen?
Well, like pieces of inspiration. We talked about lots of inspiration today already, but maybe something you could leave our audience with when it comes to making them feel good or inspired about something.
Oh, sure. Okay. Espresso for the mind. Okay. Here's my espresso for the mind. This is what I think about whenever I'm feeling a little bit like I don't know what to do next. Life's overwhelming. I think about chance, random chance and probability. So if you're sitting there feeling a bit like, what am I doing and why am I here? Just think that in order for you to be here right now, looking back over time, if you visualize it, so many things had to happen. So many people had to meet. If you just go back a few generations, you've got your parents, your grandparents, your great grandparents, but now go back thousands and thousands and thousands and thousands and thousands, and thousands of years. And just think about all of the astonishingly microscopic random chances that have led to you being alive today. And no matter how unbelievably challenging life can feel at any one moment, it is such a incredibly unlikely thing that you're here right now. And I think for me personally, when I remember that, it puts things in perspective a little bit. And I think, first of all, wow, I'm here. That's pretty remarkable. And second of all, I think even if all that I achieved today is going outside and taking a deep breath of fresh air and looking at the trees, looking up at the sky, and feeling kind of the earth turn underneath me, then that's a pretty good achievement for one day considering the incredibly unlikely nature of
totally.
Existence at all. So that's my mind.
Espresso. Wonderful. Wonderful. And considering the fact that in those eons of human existence on this planet, we as the current generation, so whoever is alive right now is the best version of that species so far. And that's interesting because evolution brings forth ever better versions of itself. So whoever is alive right now is the optimum output of Homo, the species Homo on this planet. We should also consider that. Maybe also those we do not like, they are still the optimal output of evolution.
Oh, that's an interesting kind of way of thinking, Marcus. I'm not sure I'd agree with you, but we'll have to consider that later.
Yes.
I don't know. I'm not sure that physical fitness for the environment is necessarily a determiner of best. I think there have been some pretty fabulous people historically, and there'll be some pretty dire ones to come. But but that is an interesting thought. But I would encourage people, if you have a moment, to go and lie in a park somewhere in the sun under a tree and look up through the tree. Put your arms out on either side and just see if you can feel the earth turn.
Yeah.
That's a good thing to do.
Annie Hadmer, thank you so much for that time. You're very inspiring.
Thank you so much, Marcus. It's been wonderful to chat. And if anyone's interested in knowing more about unknown objects or reading about this random piece of debris that we found floating around the place, please do head to the website. Just search HEO Robotics, H-E-O Robotics. And you can download the white paper there. And if you know of a UFO near you and you want to let me know about it,
we will.
Yeah. So reach out. I'm on Twitter. Like, just tweet me. I'll go look for you.
By the way, is Space Junk still around, that podcast?
The podcast Space Junk. Yes, it is. It is currently taking a little bit of a break because I've been so unbelievably busy with everything. But I do intend to keep running it eventually. So
good.
Stand by. If you keep subscribed, maybe in 12 months there'll be another episode. But I make no promises. So, but anyway, there are still 50 back episodes if you're interested in listening. Yeah.
Super. Annie, thank you so much.
Thank you. Great to chat.
Thank you all for staying with us today. If you have anything to share or suggest, send a message to podcast@spacecafe.global. We read every single message, promised. And we truly appreciate you sharing your valuable time with us. Thank you, and see you next time. Bye-bye.